For quite some time, I've been more concerned about God's rights than my rights. We talk a lot about these days about human rights. You hear about this all the time, and I think that that's a good thing. Obviously, people should know their rights as part of humanity. But ultimately, all of our rights are just privileges when we relate it to God. The rights that God has given to us are rights among ourselves. It's a lateral thing. But in the vertical thing relating to God, it's all a privilege, because it's a privilege that he has given us rights. That makes sense? Rights and privileges are two different things. Privileges are granted by somebody else, such as government. Government grants privileges. Government does not grant rights. And this was built into the Constitution come some years back, you know, a little over 200 years ago, when they said that actually in the Declaration of Independence, on which the Constitution was built, which said that that all men have been endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, the Supreme Court ruled on this many times over the years, but particularly in the 1880s, about 1886, there was one very well-known case where, I've lost the quote now, I wish I had it again, but it said very specifically, in quoting the Declaration of Independence, it was actually a tax case, that government did not have the right to tax your labor, because your labor is a right given by God, and the government had no right to tax your rights. It could only enforce your rights. But if the government gives you a right, it's not a right at all. It's a privilege, because the government giveth and the government taketh away. If you can grant it, then you can take it away. See, because you stand above that which you grant. And so so they quoted the Declaration of Independence and said specifically that all rights come from your Creator and not from government. Boy, are we far from that today. When they kicked God out of government and out of the world itself, what they were really doing was denying the rights of God as Creator. He has rights as Creator. And so it really all starts in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Everything flows from there, because that's the first truth of Scripture that we need to understand. God has rights by right of creation. He has the right to rule all nations. He has the right to legislate what is right and what is wrong. He has the right to command and expect obedience. He has the right to decide what is good and what is not. He has all these rights. And the fact that he gave 10 commandments, for instance, shows that he had the right to legislate morality, if you will. Now, that's something that they try to tell you. You can't legislate morality. Well, yes, you can, and every law legislates morality. They don't tell you that, of course. But every law attempts to regulate morality. It tells you you can't do this or you can't do that because that infringes on the rights of your neighbor. So every law does that. What the law cannot do is to change your heart. So you can legislate morality, but don't expect to become in your being a moral person by legislation of law. Okay, the law is weak in that way. It's not the overall solution to everything. Nonetheless, it does establish the character of God. Now, the old covenant was the way of trying to command people to be obedient, whereas the new covenant takes the law and makes them a promise of what God is doing in your heart. And in that way, the law becomes written on your heart so that you do fulfill what the law says, not because you've been commanded to it and so that you can force your flesh to do something good. That's the old covenant method. But because the Holy Spirit is working within us to write the law in our hearts so that we do it not by compulsion, but by nature. God is really not satisfied until we are in full compliance with His character, His image, His will by nature. And that's really what it is. And so when we read that we are to conform ourselves to the image of Christ, that is a command, and you have many, many commandments in the New Testament that are offshoots of the original law. But, you know, in coming into conformity to the image of Christ, we can command ourselves to do that, but we're not going to be all that successful. We can subject ourselves and beat up ourselves until we our human nature is forced into compliance. And, well, that beats the alternative. It beats going out and robbing your neighbor or killing them. Of course, there's nothing wrong with beating yourselves, you know, buffeting your body into subjection. But that does not make anybody righteous. Anything that is imposed from the outside is not going to work except on a limited way. It has to really come from the inside. And that is why the Holy Spirit is so important in our life. And it's a matter of, the process in that is, of course, hearing His voice, because to hear and to obey are the same Hebrew word, and Greek too, by the way. And so, if a person says that they hear but don't obey, have they really heard? Don't think so, because they haven't followed through on the last half of the meaning of that word. So, God has the right not only to be obeyed, but He has the right for you to come into His image. And by the way, He's in the process of exercising His rights. Okay? And in the end, because He's the creator of all things, He is responsible for that which is created. And all of His laws tell us that, especially in Exodus 22, where you have the laws of liability. And you see that if you create a fire and it gets out of hand, the one who created the fire is responsible. In other words, whoever lit the fire owns the fire. And so if it breaks out and burns up the field, the one who lit the fire is responsible for it, because he's the creator of the fire. If a man owns an ox and the ox gores somebody, it's the owner that is liable by the law. Even though the owner might also take it out on the ox, that does not mean that the owner is not responsible. He is responsible regardless of what he does with the ox. And God has done the same with us. With humanity that has gone astray, all we like sheep have gone astray, ultimately, the responsibility falls upon God, because God is our creator. He's our Father. He is the one in authority. He's the one that has sovereignty. Okay? Every authority that we have is only authority. No man has sovereignty like God does. Authority is always authorized by a higher power. When you get to God, there is no higher power. He didn't get his power by authorization from somebody else. And contrary to popular opinion, God didn't get his sovereignty by being authorized by you and me either. Now, I know, it's a shock to your system. But there are people who actually live by that, whether they will admit it or not. We do not empower God, but God already has the power. And so, if God is responsible we find that it's a general principle of life and the way God has set things up, that your level of authority or sovereignty comes in direct proportion or equal to your responsibility and liability as well. Nobody should have more liability than their responsibility, or less. And God is the same way. God takes responsibility all the time throughout scriptures, you know. You read about things that happen, and the scriptures attribute it to what God did. Well, God didn't do it directly, but, you know, it was some other guy that did it, good or bad, but God takes the credit for it. So there's more happening than actually is written in scripture sometimes. You know, I mean, if they really wanted to get picky about it, they could write, okay, in this situation, you know, God inspired somebody to do it this way, and then he did it. You know, we could list the whole process, but the scriptures usually just pass over that and assume that you already know this. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't already know this, and so they miss it. Responsibility and authority go hand in hand, equal measures. And that's the biblical justice according to the mind of God. So if God is a creator, then obviously he's responsible for everything. Everything he created, anyway. And I can't think of anything he didn't create, directly or indirectly. See, man makes things, God creates. But if God didn't create something, man wouldn't be able to make it in the first place. So whereas God may not be the direct agent to make this or that, like some furniture, man says, okay, I'm a carpenter and I've made this beautiful cabinet. It's mine. Yeah, it's yours. All the labor you put into it is yours. But God put some labor into building the tree. Nobody can make that cabinet unless they have first taken something that God has already labored and made. You see, he created it. And so God has partial ownership in everything. And everything about ownership has to do with your labor. What you labor for, God says that's yours. But what I labor for, that's mine. And virtually everything is a partnership. And that's where the principle of the tithe comes in. Because God wants a 10% return on his labor. He's not taxing your labor, he's taxing his labor. Okay? There's the difference. Government taxes your labor, God taxes his own. He wants a return on his own labor. Okay? And that's one of the principles of justice in regard to the laws against theft. You know, thou shalt not steal. And the government says, oh, but I'm the chief stealer. I'm the head thief of all things. But in order to do that, you have to remove God from government, which is what they've been trying to do, and quite successfully, particularly since the 30s. But when they do that, you see, that leaves a power vacuum in the minds of men and leaves the government as as God. So government takes the place of God and literally then becomes a usurper of the authority of God, and a usurper is an antichrist. Okay? Because Christ is the heir to all things. If we kick him out and assume his throne, whoever assumes his throne is an antichrist. There are many antichrists. Okay? I've met some. In fact, I've talked to myself quite often. No. I mean, we've got that man of sin within us too, okay? Because we all share in this, we all participate in the problem. We have to in order for Christ to come and deliver us from that problem. Well, so God has rights. And as advocates of his kingdom, part of our job description, in fact, one of the highest job description that we have, is to advocate God's rights. So if the government wants to advocate its rights or human rights or whatever it is, That's fine, but our focus is, first of all, on advocating God's rights. God has the right to rule this country and every other country and the whole world, all of creation, even things that are not countries. He has the right to rule everything that he has created in heaven and in earth, because his kingdom is everything that he has created. Okay? And that's heaven and earth. His kingdom is not just heaven, nor is it just earth. It's heaven and earth, because that's what he created at the beginning. Therefore, he owns it. Therefore, it's his kingdom. And so, there are some people who are a little too earthly-minded and some who are a little too heavenly-minded. We ought to get together again and balance each other off and say, hey, God owns it all. And he wants it all, I might add. Okay? He wants it all. This isn't just going to get torched in the end. This earth is his footstool. A footstool, by the way, is, we often don't think about what a footstool is. But a footstool is where you sit back on your couch and you can rest your feet. It's kind of nice, right? It's a place of rest. Think about that. Being a footstool is not a shameful thing. It's a good thing, because God desires the earth to be his footstool so that he can kick back and relax and do some fishing. And, when his labor is over in regard to this whole thing called heaven and earth, the creation. And it's all about entering into God's rest, which is, of course, the main force of the fourth commandment. The fourth commandment about the Sabbath rest. It's all about entering into God's rest. And ultimately, it's not just about you entering into God's rest, but God has to have a rest first before you can enter into his rest. Right? How are you going to enter into his rest if he's not resting? So, when in his rest, he needs a footstool. So when he can finally kick back and say, yeah, it's all good, now we've restored all things, okay, now God has rested fully from his labors, and we are privileged to enter into his rest as well, because now the whole earth is at rest, and there's reconciliation in the heavens and in the earth. Right now we're in a time of spiritual warfare. There's turmoil in the second heavens. There will be a time, though, when that ceases and everything is fully restored and reconciled to him, where all enemies have been reconciled, and there's no more enemies to fight anymore. And there's no conflict, there's no disagreement. Everybody knows the truth. Nobody will have to teach their neighbor saying, know the truth, because everybody will know me from the beginning, you know, from the youngest to the oldest, you know. And that is when the new covenant has fully been implemented in heaven and earth. But for that new covenant to be fully implemented, it requires a heart change and not just behavior change. The law normally is applied, according to the old covenant, the law is applied to regulate behavior. But under the new covenant, it's applied to change your nature itself, which is the root cause of your behavior. Okay? It's still the same law, it's just that one method didn't work, and one method does work. The old method didn't work because most of the people did not submit to the divine law, and so they preferred, their flesh preferred to sin. So the majority has always failed in that attempt. In fact, I'll go so far as to say that those who succeeded in the Old Testament actually succeeded under the New Covenant. You think the New Covenant didn't begin until Acts chapter 2? Moses talked about the New Covenant. Jeremiah did. He's going to create a New Covenant. And in fact, the New Covenant is based on faith. Tell me one believer in the Old Testament that didn't have faith. That's not a New Testament concept. That's been with us since the beginning. And we hear that faith comes by hearing. How many of these people in the Old Testament heard the voice of God? Well, that's not just a New Covenant thing. Well, it is a New Covenant thing, but it's not just a post-Acts 2 experience. Everybody's supposed to hear his word. Right? And so, because hearing is obeying. Now, let me explain that, you know, some people, when we talk about hearing God's voice, some people get freaked out about it because they think you have to hear an audible voice coming, you know, accompanied by some great bolt of lightning or something. And I'll tell you up front right now, I've never heard the audible voice of God that I know of. If I did, I thought it was somebody else. But, you know, I guess like Balaam, you know, he thought the donkey was speaking to him. You know, sometimes, you know, but it's a matter of recognizing when you hear the voice of God through other people or through other things, signs and wonders or people or whatever, however God speaks. And frankly, you have all heard the voice of God at some point, and you because God is always speaking. He's a big blabbermouth, as Ron would say. He's always talking. We just don't always take heed to what he is saying. So really, hearing God's voice is not so difficult. People have a hard time and they get frustrated because they just can't hear God's voice, but they're trying too hard. They're trying so hard that they miss what they're hearing all the time. It's so easy, then that's the reason why we think we don't hear God's voice, because it's too easy. Right? I tried real hard years ago, too, until I finally relaxed, and then suddenly, well, oh, was that his voice? Well, I've heard his voice all along. I remember his voice from a child. But I didn't, somehow it didn't connect, you know? It was some kind of a gap in my brain there. And we need to fill in that gap. You know, somebody needed to stand in the gap. So, anyway, okay. I want to say something about the third commandment today, because the third commandment governs the entire system of God's justice. Okay? It's the basic, well, I mean, they all do in some way, because all of the laws are interrelated. And so what you say about one commandment, you could actually say about all of them. But some are sort of the lead revelation. And then they all sort of fall in line. The third commandment says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And of course, this has traditionally been interpreted to mean that you have to refrain from speaking certain swear words, cuss words, if you're from the South. And what was that, Bob? Those of you who are in computers, you shouldn't use a cursor, you should use a blesser. Okay, great. Great. But taking his name in vain is essentially calling upon his name to bear witness to what you are presenting, and essentially saying that this is truth, or this is established, and you're asking God to double witness it. In a court of law, in the biblical times, when somebody went to court, they could, they were sworn in. Right? So help me God type of thing, you know, put the hand on the Bible and so on. And if they lied on the stand under oath, then they could be charged with perjury. There's very little charges of perjury these days, a lot more, especially the higher up you go into the political realm, the less they charge people with perjury. You know, and sometimes they get around it with the meaning of the word is, you know, and stuff like that, which, you know, using legalisms to get around the law so that you can be immoral and still, by legalism, you haven't quite, you know, literally broke the letter of the law, therefore it's okay. Well, God's law doesn't operate that way. Okay? God operates by the spirit of the law as well as the letter. You know, the letter is just here is the means of communication as best we can in our language, but there is a whole spirit of the law that is behind it. It's like the iceberg that you saw last night. You know, you got the little tip of the iceberg over the water, but 90% of it is underwater. Well, that's kind of like it is here. You know, the commandment is just the tip of the iceberg, but then the rest of the iceberg, 90% of it is the spirit of the law that supports that statement. And that's how we can understand what God is actually speaking when he gives a simple command. Don't have any, or don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. All oaths in a biblical court of law invoke the name of God as a witness to the truth of some sort of testimony. And in cases where you cannot prove that somebody sinned or committed a crime, sin is crime, by the way, if you cannot prove that somebody sinned against you, you know, because you have to have two or three witnesses in order to be able to present a case before the court, you could still get justice. Justice is one of your rights, and God will uphold your right to justice. We see this especially coming forth in Numbers chapter 5, which is a chapter that deals with how to obtain justice when justice is not possible for some reason. I mean, you might have a corrupt judge, they got bribed, what are you going to do? Well, you have to submit to the decision of the judge, but you can appeal it to the Supreme Court. That is, the divine court. In Numbers 5, you have a couple of examples, but one of them is the law of jealousy. That is, if that's what it was called. If a man suspects that his wife had an affair, but he can't prove it, he can take her then to the court, to the priest, and the priest will administer an oath. So she has to take an oath of innocence and register her oath in the divine court in that way as being absolute truth. Now, if she is lying when she does that, then that is a violation of the third commandment, taking his name in vain. Because she would be essentially going there and taking an oath and calling upon God to bear witness to the truth of her statement. So if it is true, that's fine. If it is not, then God is brought into the case and he judges the case personally. And that, of course, goes by, with a legal process that we were talking about last summer in my newsletters with when God comes and does a divine investigation, and it's called in the Bible a visitation. I guess I better not get into all that because we'll never get out of that subject. But when Jesus said to Jerusalem, "You did not know the time of your visitation," that was just a little statement regarding a 4-year investigation that had begun with John the Baptist. John did it for the first year. Jesus did it for 3 years. You had a 4-year investigation. And at the end of that, Jesus says, you know, you didn't know the time of your investigation here, your visitation. It wasn't the fact that Jesus was coming for a visit. That wasn't really the force of it. This term is a legal term that has to do with a divine investigation to see if this tree was going to bear fruit. And the axe was laid at the root of the trees and so on. Jesus cursed the fig tree. All of this stuff brought judgment at the end of that time because they did not bear fruit. So that's what the investigation was about, you know, in Sodom and Gomorrah. They came down to do a divine investigation there too. You remember that story. But all of this is a time of visitation, and that's the legal term that the Bible uses. Well, when people appeal to the divine court, God then does a visitation to see if it's true. He's acting like a judge, and apparently with Sodom and Gomorrah, righteous Lot, had appealed to God for justice in this ungodly city, town, region. And so God came down, and it wasn't just him, not just Lot, but probably others too. Because it says in the Word that I will now go down and see if this is true, because the cry of the people has come up to my throne here. Oh, so they appealed to God, huh? Did the people of Sodom and Gomorrah have the right to appeal? They did, because there was no justice in Sodom and Gomorrah. What's interesting is that in Isaiah 1, the prophet talks about Israel as being like Sodom and Gomorrah, and if it hadn't been for a remnant, they would have been like Sodom and Gomorrah. So they were like Sodom and Gomorrah in every way except the fact that there was a remnant there. Well, Lot was taken out. He represented a remnant in that time before divine judgment. There's a remnant in America today and in the house of Israel in general today, however you want to take it, among all nations. And now in recent years, we are privileged to now finally reach the point where we really are Sodom and Gomorrah. And we're seeing that unfold before our eyes right now today. Well, it was prophesied in Isaiah 1, so I guess we always had to drop down to that level before the time of the end. It has to be gross darkness to people before the light of God shines out. What is this gross darkness? Well, I think it's gross immorality, which is the term that is used in the book of Jude, by the way, regarding Sodom and Gomorrah. See, that word immorality or fornication is porneia, but in Jude, it uses the term, it has a prefix that means gross immorality, and that's how it's translated in the NASB as well. So when you have gross darkness, I think that it's the same thing. But I think that we're now coming finally to that place of gross darkness where it's time for the light to shine. And in fact, the darker it is, the more your light can shine. So, we are a contrast to the world. Whereas much of the church is trying to conform to the world so that they don't stand out, so they don't look bad, so they're not accused of being righteous, which they don't really like to be accused of that. They're wanting to fit in, you know, and it's typical childhood stuff, immaturity stuff, you know, where as children we just want to fit in, and we don't like it when we don't fit in with the crowd, you know. We're all part of the dog pack, you know, and whoever leads, they're the ones we follow. Well, okay, that's enough of the rabbit trail. Get back to the third commandment here. In Hebrews 6:16, it says, "An oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute." Now, I read that for years and years and years, for decades, and it never really understood what that meant. I didn't know that this had to do with the basic principle of biblical law that says that if you have a dispute, but you can't prove it, so therefore an earthly court can't rule on it, you can always get justice because you can always go to the divine court and, you know, take an oath of innocence, and God will then handle the case. And you have to then drop the case, you know, let God handle it. And like in the case of a law of jealousy, when the woman takes her oath of innocence, the man is supposed to drop the case. It ends every dispute. Well, hopefully it does anyway. It's supposed to. In real life, I'm not sure that that always happened. There probably was a little bickering going on yet. But nonetheless, an oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. And of course, the book of Hebrews, the author of the Hebrews book, understood the principle of biblical law. Now, what's interesting is that during the Middle Ages, in the medieval times, they had a partial understanding of this appeal to the divine court thing. But for some reason, they did not understand the law well enough, and so they presumed guilt unless you could prove innocence. Now, when the Protestant Reformation came about, and the scriptures, more important, the scriptures began to be disseminated by the printing press in the 1450s, so that more people could own copies of the scriptures, and it didn't cost $1 million, they could actually start to study this and read through the scriptures for themselves. And many of them started in Genesis instead of Matthew, which I commend them for. And they wanted to read every word that comes out of the mouth of God, and not just the last part. And so they began to see that, they began to understand that the law of God presumed innocence unless you could prove guilt. You had to have two or three witnesses to prove guilt. You didn't have to have two or three witnesses to prove innocence. Okay? And so that is how our American society got this principle embedded in it, even though it's been somewhat perverted by other things. Nonetheless, it's one of the bedrock principles of justice in the world today. They finally have recognized it. But in the Middle Ages, they had this thing called trial by ordeal. They might, if they suspected that somebody was, let's say, a witch, they'd tie a rock around her ankle and throw her in the river and watch to see if God would do a miracle to save her. In other words, God would have to intervene to prove her innocence, but otherwise she's assumed guilty. Or they might burn them at the stake. And, you know, they would say, okay, God is up to you. If you save her, then we'll know that she's innocent. And most of them burned at the stake. I don't know of many examples that escaped that. But you see, it was that principle. They understood about the divine court in a very mild way. Didn't really understand much. When it came down to it, they believed that God would intervene if the person was innocent. But this reverses the biblical principle. In the biblical principle, for instance, in the law of jealousy, if the woman were guilty, having taken an oath, then she would become barren. She would receive the curse of the law because she had taken the name of the Lord thy God in vain. You see? But the people, the priest, was not to give her a trial by ordeal and do a hysterectomy on her or something like that, and then see if she can still give birth, you know, by some kind of a divine miracle. That's not how it worked in the Bible. These are very important principles in society, because if we didn't have this principle today, we would all be suffering for it, like they did in the centuries past. Well, what it means is that we can obtain justice all the time. God has given us the right to have justice. Now, this is balanced with the principle that I presented last year, where we have the laws of victims' rights. The law of victims' rights is not just the right to forgive, but also the right to receive justice. Okay, you have both rights. If you're innocent, you have the right, you have certain rights. If you have been victimized, you have the right not only to prosecute and get justice, but you also have the right to forgive. It's a two-sided coin here. And God gives us that right. Over the past thousands of years, men have not really fully understood this, and they have thought that justice was their only real right, and they thought that the right to forgive, it wasn't a right to forgive. They had a duty to prosecute. They changed it to duty instead of a right, which the moment it becomes a duty to prosecute and get justice, that removes the right of people to forgive. You can't remove that. So you have a right of justice, but not a duty of justice. The judge does, but not the victim. The judge has to impose justice. If the victim is prosecuting it, then the judge must recognize the right of the victim to receive justice. But having given that, the victim has every right to forgive part of it or the whole thing. And so we see this is a basic principle of all creation, because God is the ultimate victim, and he has the right to forgive, and he has the right to justice. He's got both of these rights. Now, let's not deprive God of any of his rights. So we find in Scripture that, yes, he will indeed forgive all sin, but he also has a right of justice. Now, for us, maybe we can illustrate it like this. If somebody steals everything that I have, which, of course, is only a misdemeanor, but suppose somebody steals everything that I have, and I'm left destitute, and I know who did it, and I can prove it, so I can take them to court. Or I could forgive the whole thing. Now, which would I do? Well, I would look at the situation and be led by the Spirit. Because, you see, I'm not here to establish my rights. My rights are secondary to God's rights. If I look at my rights, what I'm really doing is I'm focusing on myself, you know, and, you know, what's in it for me and how can I get my rights? Jesus made it very clear that that's not how we should look at it. We should look at it through God's eyes. Through God's eyes, he's got a big picture to look at. And so he's interested in the criminal as well as the victim. He wants to restore the criminal because he loves the criminal as much as he loves the victim. And so what would God do, you see? And so we have to ask ourselves, the criminal has committed a sin against me. How can I best help him? Can I best help him by just forgiving it all and so that he says, I got away with this, let me go try this with somebody else? And of course, then he has to look for overcomers who are willing to forgive, of course, because some others are a little less kindly, you know, toward being victimized. And so what you end up with is the forgivers are the ones that might get victimized the most. Well, does that really help the criminal to come into the image of God and to be obedient to him? Does forgiveness really help him? It can, under certain circumstances, but you have to discern, because that's not always the best tactic to take. It might be better to make him work it off so that he understands the value of labor instead of thievery. You see? It's the same thing with our children. If every time they do something wrong, we just forgive it, they probably are not going to grow up as good citizens of the kingdom. They need to be held accountable. It's for their good. It's not out of malice. It's not because, oh, I want my rights. It's because we are thinking of them. And so sometimes it is better to seek justice and yet understand that justice is not the end of this whole thing. What's really our real goal is to cause the sinner to come into a place of spiritual maturity. Sometimes that has to be done by holding them accountable. And yet the victim has the right, okay, to either justice or grace and mercy. And these principles mean that you have to be led by the Spirit, because everybody here has been victimized in some way. Many times, I'm sure. Unless you haven't been born yet. Well, even then you have, because Adam victimized you. Okay? You became mortal because of Adam's sin. So you see, we have this problem, and the more that we are able to be led by the Spirit, then we can see the world through the eyes of Christ and ask ourselves, what would Jesus do? How would he handle this situation? And being led by the Spirit is therefore very important. So the important thing is that we need to know that justice is not a duty, neither is forgiveness a duty, by the way. Now, personal forgiveness as far as your emotional thing, yes, of course. But insofar as your actual treatment of the one who has victimized you, you have to be discerning on this and find out what is actually the course that God would have you take. Well, now, take this on to the higher picture, because God himself has been victimized many times, okay? And so he's like the ultimate victim. And so Christ came and he was the ultimate victim. He, you know, took upon himself the blame for all the sins beginning with Adam, the whole world, everything that had happened and everything that was happening and everything that will happen. Okay? That gives him certain rights as a victim. He has the right, because he was blamed for every sin that ever was committed and ever would be committed, he has the right to forgive everything that he was accused of. Everything, all the sin that he took upon his shoulders, he has the right to forgive. The only sins he does not have the right to forgive are those that were not placed upon him on the cross. Think about it. The question is, how is he going to forgive? What is the best course of action to take? So you read the scriptures and you find out what did he actually do, looking at it from this perspective. Did he just wipe everything out and say, oh, boys will be boys, you know, no more judgment for sin? Well, look out there. There's judgment for sin all the time. Everything is happening. There's consequences to everything. Whole nations get judged. We've seen that before the cross and after. Horrible things have happened to people. And eventually, I believe also we have this thing called a white throne judgment, where every knee will bow. But there is where you have all the past sin that has not been dealt with one way or the other, either because they have not, sin that's not been dealt with, will be dealt with at some point, because it has to be resolved. Everything has to be resolved, and it will all be resolved because of the cross. But there's a few steps in between here before that actually works out. So how does God do it? Does he hold people accountable? Well, yeah. I mean, read through the scriptures, talk about it all the time, Old and New Covenant scriptures both. It talks about divine judgment, you know, and people being held accountable. Yeah, God holds people accountable, but he's in the end, there is a built-in forgiveness here, and it's what we call the law of Jubilee. In any court decision, when you have people held accountable, and they are, if they have nothing, they shall be sold for their theft, they basically have to come under the authority of somebody else and work off the debt. And in a case where they cannot, you know, the debt is too big and they cannot work it all off, well, they work until the year of Jubilee, and then it's canceled regardless. See, that's where grace finally kicks in. But first of all, you have people held accountable for a time before they get the law of grace, which is the Jubilee, when all debts are canceled, whatever is left, just purely by grace. It has nothing to do with what they have earned or worked off or anything. And so I believe we're having the same problem, or being resolved at the Great White Throne. I believe there is an age to come where there is judgment, and the New Testament talks about the aeonian judgment, or judgment in the age that is to come. And when you have this judgment, what is it? Well, in my view, they are the unbelievers, those who have not pleaded their case by the blood of Christ. Okay, unbelievers will be held accountable for their own sin. It's as they say, every man is judged according to his works. And then they're cast into this lake of fire. Well, the lake of fire, I believe, is the fiery law. It's basically the justice of the divine law. And because the law is the fire, and it proceeds from the throne of God. The throne is a symbol of law. The monarch sits on the throne. He rules by law. And when this fiery stream issues forth from the throne of God, as we see in Daniel 7, it comes upon the people who are rising from the dead. And then it becomes a lake. Okay, and that's called a lake of fire. The stream forms a lake. Well, and it has to do with the divine law being applied and judging the people, not to destroy them, but so that they can be brought into conformity to the character of Christ, which is expressed in the law. This is the law being written on their hearts. Now, a part of this law also, you know, like I said, all the laws relate to each other, and so you know you have to understand the whole law in order to understand any part of it, because everything is related. The third commandment is also related to the ninth commandment, well, and the second, and all of them. It's related to the first commandment because the third commandment says that you have to take an oath, or don't take the Lord, name of the Lord your God in vain. But if you don't have the first commandment that establishes who that is, you know, who is the Lord, then how are you going to have the third commandment without the first? You see what I mean? And the ninth commandment is about bearing false witness. And this includes the law of witnesses, you know, the two or three witnesses that establish all truth and everything. And so you see how these things all relate. But the third commandment, there's an interesting law that comes in here, and it's in Leviticus chapter 5, verse 1. I call it the law of public adjuration. Now, that's not adoration. That's the law of Christmas. But the Leviticus 5:1, it's a little bit convoluted in the way a lot of translators have it. But the NASB says, "Now, if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify, or a public oath to testify, when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, if he doesn't come forth with the truth and testify, then he will bear his guilt." And that's what the sin is. So the wording is a little bit difficult, but if I can rearrange the sentence a little bit. If a man hears a public adjuration to testify, and he is a witness in a crime, he has some bearing, he is something to testify in relation to this crime, and he doesn't do it, even though there's been a public adjuration here to, you know, all witnesses come forth, then he bears his guilt. Now, this law of public adjuration, it's a judicial act in which the public is sworn in as a collective witness in a case. It means that nobody has the right out there to withhold evidence if they know it or if they've seen it or heard it. And so this public adjuration means that if somebody does not come forth and testify, then they are false witnesses. Not so much a false witness, but they're not a faithful witness. See, in the New Testament, we see that Jesus was the true and faithful witness. He was a true witness, but also a faithful witness. He's a true witness because he did everything he saw his Father do, said everything that he heard his Father say. That made him a true witness. But he was a faithful witness because he was faithful to actually do so. Because God has, in essence, issued a public adjuration to the whole world to testify. And in fact, that's why the disciples had to testify the things that they had seen and heard in the Great Commission. You know, they had to testify that Jesus Christ had been raised from the dead, you know, and that he was the Messiah. So when, in the book of Acts, when the high priest told them, you know, they commanded them that they should not speak in the name of Jesus, they said, you tell us if we're supposed to or not. What does the law say? We can't help but speak and testify what we have heard. That's by this law of public adjuration. They were required to testify what they had seen and heard. You see, because this was like a big public courtroom in the whole world where people were supposed to know what the truth was. So we find that in the great Palm Sunday experience there, where he comes into Jerusalem, in Luke 19, it says, the whole multitude of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles which they had seen. It occurred to me that somewhere in outer space, there was a public adjuration that had preceded this, and everybody was supposed to testify what they had seen or heard. And suddenly, they all broke forth into praise, testifying about all the miracles that they had seen and heard, and they said, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. And some of the Pharisees said, teacher, rebuke your disciples. And he answered and said, I tell you, if these become silent, the stones will cry out. See, even the stones had to cry out because they too were witnesses of what they had seen and heard. Every word is recorded on the walls here, and if you could get a sensitive enough record player, you could actually hear what has been going on ever since this building was built. The very stones cry out. And so this is all an offshoot of this law of public adjuration. Well, when Jesus then came into trial, he was silent. He didn't try to defend himself, but he just didn't say anything. He refused to talk to the high priest. And the whole high priest, you know, they went and they brought in their false witnesses, you know, but they all contradicted each other and they couldn't get anywhere. And finally, the high priest got really fed up with it all and got disgusted. And so he did what the law said that he had the right to do. It says, Jesus kept silent, and the high priest stood up and said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. Well, then the whole thing came out, because now he had been adjured by the high priest according to the law of Leviticus 5:1, and he was required to testify the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So he not only said, yes, he says, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Woo! Well, there is where he got charged for blasphemy, because they assumed that he was not the Christ. See, the court had already decided the case. The fact is, they were adjuring him. They were essentially calling upon God because he's testifying against himself. Their court case had ended, and they were appealing to God. And so by this oath, which should have ended all controversy and set him free and let God judge him if he was not the Messiah, instead of doing that, they took the law into their own hands and crucified him. They misused the law because they didn't really understand it either. Or if they did, they didn't care. We're not told. But it's very interesting that how this law of public adjuration works. And this is sort of the essence of how the third commandment works, because the third commandment governs the overall governing law regarding the judicial system and how to obtain justice in the world in every case, because justice will be done in every case, just not all at once. And in fact, in this age, very little justice is actually done. But we have the right to appeal to the higher court, and this is what we do a lot. But we're not appealing simply for justice. We have to be led by the Spirit so that we know when to appeal for justice, when to appeal for mercy, and when to stand in the gap for those who are actually guilty. You know, and these are the things that require us to be led by the Spirit. So it's not enough to know the law. It sure is helpful, because you know you can be led by the Spirit without knowing the law. The Lord can always overrule your ignorance, but it's a whole lot better if the Spirit of God has something to work with. At least I've found that to be true in my life. The Lord does not reveal everything, and even Spirit-filled people can go through life in a very simple gospel or a simple way of life where, yes, they're led by the Spirit, but there's a very little understanding that goes with it. And if you read the Proverbs, you'll find what Solomon has to say about understanding. Understanding is very important. And I found that there's no substitute for understanding. It just is nice. You don't have to have it, but boy, is it nice. Understanding, by the way, is that Hebrew word bina, and the beth is a house. There's a yod in there, and then there's a nun, which is a swarm of fish, or it really means life. And then the hay at the end, which means what comes from. Now, the yod there right after the beth, the yod makes it possessive. And so it's not just a house, it's my house. Okay, like El and Eli or Eli, which means my God. You know, remember, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Eli. So the beth with the yod is my house, then the house of life. And so the whole word means, understanding literally means what comes from the house of life, or my house of life. That is what understanding is. So it's kind of an interesting thing when you look at the actual Hebrew word pictures, in which I believe is the spiritual meaning behind each of the words. So if we have understanding, then this is a flow of life that is coming from my house, and for each of us. So with all your get understanding, as Solomon said.